From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan State University suspends the funds to pay for mental health counseling for sexual abuse victims of a university sports doctor. MSU says it's investigating fraud.
There's really no timeline for how long that investigation might take.
We talk with author Anna Clark about her book on the Flint water crisis.
Drinking water regulations for lead, they're full of loopholes that make it seem as if there's less lead in the water than there really is.
A hazardous waste treatment facility in a Detroit East Side neighborhood wants to expand. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality is reviewing the request.
It would require standards that are protective of public health and the environment. That's what we do.
But an environmental lawyer says he does not think DEQ is living up to its name.
Citizens of Detroit, and really citizens of the entire state, deserve a Department of Environmental Quality that is looking out for them and their public health.
All that plus an audio postcard from Western Michigan. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan State University has stopped payments for counseling for victims of sexual abuse because of suspicion of fraud. The survivors of abuse by former MSU physician Larry Nassar had been getting help from a $10 million fund for counseling services. Those funds are now frozen. Joining us with more on that story is Matt Mincarini with the Lansing State Journal. First, let's clear up something. This $10 million fund is not part of the much larger $500 million settlement, right?
It's not. It was set up earlier this year by the Board of Trustees to set aside some money to provide counseling services or mental health services for a set of Nassar's victims and their parents. That money was established months before they agreed to the settlement.
Okay, tell me about this suspected fraud. Exactly why did MSU suspend the funds?
Earlier this week on Tuesday, the firm the university has paid to administer the fund, to dole out the money to deal with the victims and find out who is eligible and make sure people seeking money is eligible, raised some concerns to the university about possible fraudulent claims. And they asked the university for direction of what they should do. The university told them to halt all payments out of the fund while an investigation gets underway in terms of what was fraudulent, if anything, and kind of get to the bottom of it.
And that's the part I don't understand. Typically, you'd investigate the allegation or allegations of fraud, not suspend the whole program. Have they explained why they've done that?
Not really. Just a little bit of information from the university yesterday that they decided to halt the program or halt any money out of it until they could figure out what happened. There's really no timeline for how long that investigation might take, and there's really no additional information from the university at this point what the nature of those fraud concerns were and what vetting they were doing for the months that this program and fund had been in use. It had given out, as of the end of June, just shy of $1.2 million.
If this is for counseling services for Nassar sexual abuse victims and their families, cutting off those services for all of the people using them would not seem to be in the best interest of the victims. Has the university given any kind of indication of what it might be able to do for the victims in the meantime?
It hasn't. I think it's important to note that this fund, as it was described when it was initially set up, is only for victims who are abused at the MSU Health Clinic or who were student athletes. And so there's a large number of these victims who were abused at TwiStars only or who were abused through USA Gymnastics who are not eligible for this fund at all. But the university has not said in the interim what it will do. It did say when it set up the fund that it would reimburse for previously paid counseling services and mental health services. So it's possible that any money victims spend now on these services, the university will reimburse once they get the fund up and running again. But that is not clear at this point.
Is there any estimated time? How long will Michigan State University keep these funds frozen?
Unfortunately, no. This is all seem to be pretty new for the university. They said that they found out at some point on Tuesday, made the decision on Wednesday to freeze the fund.
Okay. That's Matt Mincarini. He reports for the Lansing State Journal. Thanks very much, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
An article in Bridge Magazine written by Joel Kurth and Lindsay Van Hulley reported on emails that have emerged in a federal lawsuit that suggest Republicans gerrymandered congressional districts despite years of claims the lines were drawn without political bias. One email from a GOP staffer, according to Bridge, bragged about cramming, quote, Dem garbage, end quote, into four Southeast Michigan congressional districts. And another, a longtime Michigan Chamber of Commerce executive, predicts the maps will keep Republicans in power for years. Joining me to discuss this are our Friday political commentators. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us via Skype. And Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, what was your reaction when you read about those emails revealed through this lawsuit by the League of Women Voters of Michigan?
Well, it certainly confirms that redistricting is, by and large, a political endeavor. There are certain rules at the state level, certain in state law, and there are rules at the federal level. But given that, it's still, by and large, a political operation, a political endeavor. And I think these emails simply confirm that, if not expose that. But I think most people that have been involved in politics or observe it knew that anyway.
Do you think it should be political?
You know, one of the issues is the potential of a constitutional amendment that would create an independent redistricting commission. My reservations about that is really an accountability issue for me. I think it should be political in the sense that making laws are political, and people are then accountable to the voters at the ballot box. So I don't look at redistricting any different than I look at, you know, passing laws in the first place.
Vicki, what was your reaction to the Bridge article?
Well, it confirmed what we knew, and that was that these districts have been extremely gerrymandered. We've got districts for Congress that are salamanders that wind all the way around the lower part of the state. For example, I live in Farmington Hills, Michigan. I am part of a district that goes through Harper Woods all the way to downtown Detroit. And yet the city of Farmington, which we share many programs with, is in a totally different district. You cannot tell me that that makes any sense at all when you're talking about trying to keep districts uniform so that you can elect a legislator that can fight for that district as a whole. So these emails just confirm that. Should it be that way? The answer is no. It is a political endeavor, but it has now become more partisan than ever. And to say that you can hold your legislators accountable if you don't like the way the district is drawn is ridiculous, because the district was already drawn to not hold your legislators accountable by virtue of the fact that their district has been drawn to protect them and their political agenda. So the question then falls around whether we should pass a voters, not politicians type of constitutional amendment, or whether we can do this legislatively. I submit that we could have done this legislatively very simply. In 2010, John Walsh submitted a bill that would require the Legislative Services Bureau, which is a nonpartisan agency of the legislature, both the Senate and the House, to draw the lines. That would take it out of the pens of Democrats and Republicans and put it into nonpartisan hands. So either way you look at it, we need to do something about gerrymandering.
Let's take a look at the U.S. Senate race. Two Republicans want the seat currently held by Debbie Stabenow: John James from Farmington Hills, your town, Vicki, and Sandy Pensler of Grosse Pointe are neck and neck in the polls. Ken, the primary election is August 7th. What do you think the differences are that voters should consider between these two candidates?
I don't think there's much difference at all. It's a little bit of choosing between twiddly-num and twiddly-dee here. I mean, they're both campaigning to position themselves as the most conservative candidate and who supports Trump the most. And from that standpoint, they're by and large indistinguishable. Now, they have different backgrounds. John James is 37, former Army pilot. Sandy Pensler is 61, kind of an investor, former business owner and economist. So they have different backgrounds, but in terms of how they're campaigning and what they're trying to advance to get elected, I just think they're indistinguishable.
Vicki, how are these Republican candidates different from Stabenow?
They're extremely different from Stabenow. First of all, Debbie Stabenow understands the political process and is the ranking member, which means she is the vice chair right now of the Senate Agriculture Committee. And should she win election and if the Democrats take control of the Senate, she would be the chair of that committee. And regardless of whether she's the chair or vice chair, she has a great deal of sway in the second largest industry in the state of Michigan, which is agriculture. And that's very important for our rural areas. She knows how to work with Democrats and Republicans. And yes, she does have a lot of political experience. And I don't find anything wrong with people who are politicians who have a great deal of political experience and know how to negotiate and compromise on getting bills passed. When it comes to the two Republican candidates, they both argue that they are pro-Trump and that they are business people and not politicians. Well, that's great in business, but unfortunately, government can't be run like a business. And when you try to run it like a business, we end up with situations like Flint and financial managers doing the wrong things in communities.
Ken, I want to give you a chance to tell me what you think of John James and Sandy Pinsler and how they stack up against Debbie Stabenow.
This race is kind of a microcosm, if you will, of sort of a phenomenon that Republicans have to deal with around the country. You know, I understand why you would snuggle up to Trump in a Republican primary, but then how do you go from that, whoever wins this, to a general election where lots of independents are not happy with Trump? I think that's the challenge here politically for not just the winner here, but for lots of Republicans around the country.
Ken Sikkema is former Republican legislator. Vicki Burnett, a former Democratic legislator. Thanks for your insight.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Lester.
Michigan, like other states, is at kind of a crossroads when it comes to marijuana policy. The drug is still illegal at the federal level, but public opinion is changing. More than 60% of Americans now favor legalizing weed. This November, Michiganders will vote on whether or not to allow recreational marijuana use. So what does this all mean for the state's economy, healthcare, or criminal justice system? Let us know your questions about the future of marijuana in Michigan. Just go to michiganradio.org, look for the stateside question box on the right side of the page. Coming up on the show, we'll talk to the author of a new book that takes a good long look at what happened to Flint and its water.
What the Flint story reveals is not just that a lot of people did wrong, but there are a lot of things that are clearly immoral that happened that are not necessarily illegal.
Then we'll head to a sports camp in Allendale where wheelchair dodgeball is taken very seriously. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Flint water crisis had many, many missteps by government officials. The end result was an entire city subjected to high levels of lead in the water, something that government officials denied, obfuscated, and sometimes just plain lied about. There's a new book that goes into great detail about what happened, why it happened, who made it happen, and the underlying reasons the stage was set for it to happen. The book's title is The Poisoned City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. It was written by Anna Clark, and she joins us now. Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
There was a lot to unpack in this book, yet it's fascinating from cover to cover. Why did you decide to write about Flint's water debacle?
Well, because there is a lot to unpack. I'm a journalist in Detroit. I've written a lot about cities, infrastructure, urban policy, a lot of the issues that have come up in the Flint story, water. And when the water crisis was breaking, I had an opportunity to do some articles about that. But this is definitely one of those stories that calls for a more in-depth examination to be able to, you know, really see how these things intersect and what the human consequences are.
So for those listeners who might not know exactly what happened, give us the short version of how Flint's water became contaminated with lead.
Sure. Well, the city of Flint had been drinking Lake Huron water from the Detroit Water Department for about 50 years. It decided it wanted to switch to a new water system. And while that water system was being built, it was going to treat water from the Flint River itself as a temporary drinking water source. The problems were that the water treatment plant did not have the upgrades necessary to treat river water, which is more complex than treating lake water. And also, most pertinently, it did not use something called corrosion control, which is what you add to the water to help keep the pipes that it passes through from disintegrating and contaminating the water. So these two things combined led to a series of water problems, not just lead, but lead, of course, is what got the greatest notice because of its very toxic and incurable consequences.
So big notice was residents started showing up with gallon jugs of yellow and brown water. People were complaining about it. They went to the city council, and they were basically ignored, even ridiculed by both local and state officials. When you've got that many people saying, hey, there's something wrong here, how can they be dismissed for an entire year?
I think we're still reckoning with that. It's very disturbing, right? I mean, when you look back, you can see that within just a few weeks of the water switch, residents were noting that something was odd about the water, its taste, in some cases its color, you know, its effect on their skin and their hair. And they were doing everything that you're supposed to do. They're calling the, you know, the city. They're calling the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, in some cases the EPA. They were showing up at public meetings. They were demonstrating. They had protests. And yet there was always a suggestion that these concerns were not that serious. And, you know, that there was this idea that if that any problem wasn't that big of a problem, or if it could easily be fixed. And it was just, there was just this constant sense of dismissal that, of course, is part of what led to this crisis being much worse than it would have been otherwise if we'd heard what the Flint residents had to say.
And the entire time, everybody was saying, look, it's safe. It's, you know, fine, drink the water, you'll be okay, just relax, in fact, is what one state official said. I'm not going to even try to get into all the details because it is a very well-documented and very detailed book. But I want to talk about some of the broad brush strokes. You note Flint would not have had an emergency manager, nor would the city have been quite the financial straits that led to an emergency manager if the legislature and the governor had not cut the share of the sales tax it's supposed to share with municipalities. How did that contribute to the problem?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. This is, you're talking about revenue sharing, which is how local governments all across the state are how they help run. You know, it's a major funding source. It's how they provide public services. So the state greatly reduced the amount of these funds that it provides to its local government some years ago. This was seemed to correlate a little bit with struggles in its own budget, with the recession, things like that. But even as the state's budget has bounced back, this money has not been restored to local governments. Some communities have unhappily but found ways to absorb that loss. In Flint and in cities like it, where it's already so strapped, this goes a long way. So if I recall, like if Flint had the money that it was owed under the arrangement, it would have had, I think it was $50
million? $55 million,
yeah, it was like $55 million more dollars in its coffers than it would have had otherwise. And of course, you know, not having that definitely made its budget much more dire and certainly contributed to the reason it was appointed an emergency manager.
And the emergency manager essentially made the decision to switch the water to the Flint rather than wait, stay on Detroit and wait for the KWA pipeline that was going to be built and serve the city. You also show that it was not a coincidence that this happened to a town with a majority black population. What does race have to do with the Flint water crisis?
Okay, there's a few different things that has to do with it. First of all, I want to make clear that like lead lines and lead-based plumbing are everywhere and it's never safe. So I don't want people to think that if they live in a more well-off community or a majority white community that they're automatically immune to water problems with this. That said, some communities, Flint included, are much more vulnerable, and that shouldn't be surprising because we've had decades of making these communities more vulnerable. So Flint, it currently has less than half the population that it had in the 1960s, so actually when it first made the switch to Detroit's water. The flight of population and businesses from that community happened immediately after fair housing laws and school desegregation laws passed. You know, this community that had been the most segregated community in the North and the third most segregated city nationwide had really hit a point of crisis, as is as its community was diversifying and growing with all these like African-American migrants from the South. And when the official segregation system began to break down, a lot of people scrammed, you know, they left, you know, and this was supported by
exited and took their wealth with them.
And they took the wealth with them. Right. And they're supported by federal policies, state policies that subsidized the communities on the outskirts and ultimately were very purposefully disinvesting from these communities, these core cities that were growing poor and ultimately majority African-American.
I want to get to something you said about that toward the end of the book. You wrote, lead is one toxic legacy in America's cities. Another is segregation, secession, redlining, and rebranding. This is the art and craft of exclusion. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, we built our cities on a separate but equal policy. We did this very explicitly through lending policies, insurance policies, restrictive covenants, exclusionary zoning. The idea that you could have an integrated and healthy city was just unfathomable to so many people. And I think we haven't really dealt with the legacy of that. The official laws might be off the books now, but we can see just with our own eyes how the legacy is still with us, how people are still living separately and unequally. And I feel like until we challenge that with the same kind of purpose, intention, and energy that our predecessors built the exclusionary systems in the first place, we don't have any hope of dismantling it.
The counter argument to that, and I hear it argued all the time, or at least I see it on the web, is that the Flint city government voted to switch from Detroit water to Flint water. So this was entirely a problem of Flint's own making. What does that argument miss?
Two things. One, the vote you're referring to, or that these other folks are referring to, it happened in March 2013. The Flint City Council voted not to switch to the Flint River, but to switch to the KWA, the ultimate source of water that was also going to draw from Lake Huron. Also, this city council vote had no power behind it. The emergency manager was in place at the time. It was rather unusual to convene the city council for a vote at the time. The emergency manager had the ultimate authority behind that. They said at the time that they wanted the city council's vote on the books should Michigan's emergency manager law collapse under legal cases that were challenging it. But despite this vote being sort of championed as a signal of the city's self-sovereignty, the vote itself was only for 16 million gallons per day of the water it was going to contract with the new water department for. The emergency manager went ahead and just increased it. it really wasn't up to the city council. It was up to the emergency manager and the state.
And, of course, the state failed in properly monitoring the water and making sure the corrosion action was taken, as you were talking about earlier. Look, I know as a journalist, you probably kept up with the Flint story as it unfolded, right?
I did my best. It's complicated.
Right. In researching and writing this book, what did you learn that surprised you?
Oh, goodness. Well, one thing that I learned that surprised me is, I learned a lot more about the history of lead, you know, which fascinated and horrified me, just how widespread its uses and what its human consequences are. I think that, the idea that it's not just a city that has in so many ways been set up to fail like Flint, vulnerable to its consequences, but all of us are, and there's something we really need to think about with how we approach our drinking water. I mean, I think what the Flint story reveals is not just that a lot of people did wrong, but there are a lot of things that are clearly immoral that happened that are not necessarily illegal, and I think we need to reflect on that as we think about what kind of world we want to live in. So nationally, the Environmental Protection Association's drinking water regulations for lead, they're full of loopholes that make it seem as if there's less lead in the water than there really is. They allow up to 10% of the community to have lots of lead in their water before it triggers any action. There's no required testing for schools or daycare centers, even though children are more vulnerable to this. I was really shocked by this. I mean, I felt surprised at how these drinking water policies were designed not with public health in mind, because zero amount of lead is safe, we know that, but was a sort of compromise. It was sort of designed with assumption that nobody's ever going to find the political will or the resources to get the lead out of our infrastructure in the first place. I would like to prove that wrong. I would love for more of our communities to think about not just like supporting our drinking water infrastructure, but doing it in a healthful and equitable way. And I think we should have environmental regulations nationally on down that support that.
So it's common practice for me not to read reviews before I read a book. I don't want to be influenced by reviewers, and not to read reviews until I've got my line of questioning figured out. So that's exactly what I did with this one, too. And then I read the reviews just before you came in.
Oh, no.
And most of them were pretty glowing, but one of them made, and you got some pretty high-profile reviews for this book, one of them made the point that you talked about the heroes, you talked about the bad actors, and you acknowledged the activists, the residents who were on the streets, but they were marginalized, and even in the hero's story, they're marginalized. What do you think of that criticism?
Well, I was a little bit surprised by that because I actually went to great pains to put the spotlight on a number of people in the community. And it was actually a point of contention during the edits of this book about how many names were appearing in the piece. My editor was a little worried that it would just confuse readers because there's so many people who are named. I really wanted to tell this story as an ensemble story, you know, because this is no individual story. It happened to a lot of people, and even beyond the residents, there's a lot of people involved in this. Cities are more than the sum of their parts, right? And I wanted to tell this story in a way that honored the multiplicity of that. I felt that was a truer way to do this. It's trickier. You know, there's reasons, you know, people want to, you know, kind of focus on one person, maybe like Aaron Brockovich or something. And that's wonderful. I love Aaron Brockovich's movie. there's a lot of good that comes out of it. But what I hope that I did here was sort of bring, you know, a lot of historical context to the diverse range of lived experiences that there are in the city. I'm trying to make the case that no one person holds all the wisdom, you know, that we really need all of us. That's the whole point of democracy. I think it's the great failure that was exposed in Flint. It was not hearing the whole. I tried to model what I believed is true in the craft of the book.
You quoted my colleague Steve Carmody in the book, and he was saying that when he retires, his last story is going to be about Flint because the story's not over. The story could be told again in another 10 years because of the lasting effect of lead. Is that the plan for you?
Well, I don't know about for me personally. I mean, I know that, well, this book is finished. I'm not finished. You know, I'm still a journalist. I really love Flint. And there's so many people that I've built relationships with that I know that I'm still going to be present and following things. But yes, speaking more broadly, I hope there are 10 books about Flint, and I hope they're paced out over years, you know, because this is a very unfolding story, certainly in the health consequences for this whole generation of children that was exposed to this lead contaminated water. We don't know yet what's going to happen to them. We don't know. That's part of what's so haunting about this. But also because the accountability piece of this is still playing out. I mean, the court cases are still in their very early stages. I mean, who knows how they're going to end up. You know, people speculate, but we don't know. So I look forward to the journalistic accounts that come in the future to put that all into perspective.
The book is The Poisoned City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. The author is Anna Clark. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Dodgeball is sort of the classic summer camp sport, right? And at Mary Freebed Jr. Wheelchair Sports Camp in Allendale, they take it pretty seriously. More than 50 kids with disabilities came from all over the Midwest to attend this year's camp. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman went to see the athletes compete for all the glory in the annual dodgeball tournament.
I am Maria Besta. I am the manager of Wheelchair Adaptive Sports and inpatient and outpatient recreational therapy. We divide the teams up evenly between ages because we have three groups, A, B, and C, and they're based on age division, so we kind of make it all even so every age is represented. And they narrow it down to the last two teams, and it gets crazy wild in there. They're all screaming and clapping and picking their favorite team to win in the end, and we have certificates and little medallions for them or that they get to win. So it's just a fun added thing. And we started it with dodgeball because they love dodgeball. It's a popular sport that we have at camp.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. What's your name?
Colton Butterworth.
How old are you, Colton?
Almost 15. I was born with my disability called spina bifida. I've been here since I was 7. When I came here, I was like, I never really think about how many people are in wheelchairs when I'm not around them. So I'm like, okay, I'm nothing because I don't know how many people are in chairs. But now that I came to this camp, I kind of know that I have a bunch more friends that are in chairs and I can interact with others.
John K. Van Oyen. I'm an instructor for the sports camp here, Junior Wheelchair Sports Camp. These kids are involved when they're, 7 years old, 8 years, 9. I got started when I was 40. So I had a late start, so I'm super, super excited that these kids have all this opportunity and be able to build up the skills and character and, their self-confidence. And that's the biggest thing for these kids, to have their self-confidence, not only in sports, but in the world.
Pending approval from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, a hazardous waste facility on Detroit's east side is set to expand almost ninefold. That's despite its history of violations and public opposition. We'll take a deep dive into the story with the MDEQ, an environmental lawyer, and a spokesperson for the facility. That's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. An Idaho-based company looks to be close to getting approval of a huge expansion of its hazardous waste facility on the east side of Detroit near Hamtramck. The company is U.S. Ecology. It takes in tens of thousands of tons of toxic chemicals and treats them. Joining us now is Richard Conforti. He's with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. That agency reviews and grants permits for facilities like this one. First of all, can you describe what this facility is and what it does exactly?
I think you hit it right on the head. They are a treatment storage facility. They take in hazardous waste for temporary storage, and they also treat liquid waste that come in.
So where is DEQ in the approval process for this U.S. Ecology expansion at the site in Detroit?
We're pretty far along the process. We started a couple years ago on this one. We're in what I would consider probably the last phase by approving the waste analysis plan. And the waste analysis plan is what describes how the facility will take in the waste that they can treat and or store.
So what does this mean? I mean, what is changing? I understand there's going to be more storage. That's the expansion?
Essentially, yes. They're going to increase storage in containers, such as like 55-gallon drums, and also storage in larger tanks. They already have the tanks on site, but right now they're storing product, and they want to convert those over to store hazardous waste. There is also some treatment. They're going to do some potentially solidification of solids that would come in.
So this is, as I understand it, it increases the amount of hazardous material they can store on site from about 76,000 gallons to about 677,000 gallons. That's a 9-time expansion. Will that mean more hazardous waste actually gets processed, or is this just storage?
It's mostly all storage. As far as processing goes, the liquids does not change. Right now, they're authorized for 144,000 gallons for treatment process on a daily basis. That number stays the same. They will be allowed to increase the solidification process of hazardous waste by 600 tons on a daily basis, which they're not doing right now as far as hazardous waste. But you're right, almost all of this is a storage capacity increase.
Now, when you say solidification, help me understand that. It's like, are you mixing concrete with liquid sludge or something like that? Or how do you solidify it?
In their process, what they would take is like put lime and cement dust into a wettish material, sluggish material, and then solidify and dry it up that way. They would then send that material off to a hazardous waste landfill or another landfill someplace else for disposal purposes.
Why does U.S. Ecology need to store so much hazardous waste at this site?
It would be a business decision so that they could then come in and store the material to a point where they can then redistribute it. What they'll do is they'll do a bulking operation. So if things come in small containers, such 1 gallons or 5 gallons, they could then combine like materials into a more efficient way of transporting to somebody else for a treatment or disposal purposes.
How much of this treated waste that doesn't get solidified goes into the Detroit sewer system and eventually into the Great Lakes system?
All the liquids that they process, they're allowed to discharge to their Great Lakes Water Authority permit, which they have what they are called an industrial pretreater or license. So they're allowed to discharge on a daily basis up to 300,000 gallons. But again, they're only authorized to treat 144,000 gallons a day. So the liquid waste that are treated go into the sewer system.
You're talking about pretreatment. Does that mean that this stuff that they're putting into the sewer system is not totally benign?
It meets the requirements that Great Lakes Water Authority puts on them. So Great Lakes Water Authority has certain criteria so that they can meet Clean Water Act. So in the liquids, by the time it gets out through the Great Lakes Water Authority wastewater treatment plant and then discharges out to the Great Lakes or wherever they discharge it to, they're allowed to be able to handle it and treat it safely so that it doesn't impact themselves what comes from U.S. Ecology.
A reporter with the Detroit Free Press, Keith Matheny, has been looking at this facility and another operation near Belleville that's also owned by U.S. Ecology. He's reported there have been fires and violations at these hazardous waste facilities near Belleville. The DEQ approved doubling the size of that treatment operation and landfill in 2012, despite all of those problems. Given the record at these sites and subsequent fines, how do you conclude that expanding any of these operations is in the interest of the public health and safety?
Well, I can't answer to the stuff at the Belleville, unfortunately. This facility is mine, but the DEQ does proceed cautiously under the federal laws to renew U.S. Ecology's licenses under Part 111. Those are our requirements. If we issued a new license for these facilities or someplace else, it'd be consistent with the operations and in this case, an expansion operations, and it would require standards that are protective of public health and the environment. That's what we do.
Okay, let's go back to the Detroit site since that's what you're working on right now. The Great Lakes Environmental Law Center notes there are more than 10,000 people living within 1 mile of that facility on the east side of Detroit. Most of them are poor, people of color, 31% are children. Some of the residents say that is the definition of environmental racism. How does or does it at all figure into your decisions to allow this facility to expand its operations?
This facility's been in this location since the 1970s. It's been an industrial complex since the 50s, prior to becoming a hazardous waste treatment facility. So based on zoning, which is put out by the city of Detroit and Wayne County, this facility is allowed to be here. As far as the number of people have been out there, our decision is made based on, as I said earlier, having standards that are protective of human health and the environment. That's what's in our rules. That's when and what will be in this license.
Does the increased truck traffic or odors or noise and et cetera, do those nuisances factor into the DEQ approval process?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when the public meetings and hearings were out, we did get comments on a lot of truck traffic in there. There's other truck traffic that's not associated with this facility. There's two brand new facilities going up over there that are not hazardous waste, so the DEQ doesn't have any control over them. But we were able to put in conditions in the permit that limits the route that the trucks can take and the number of trucks that can come into the facility on a daily basis.
When will the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality make a final decision on this site?
I can't really give you a date because we're in the process of working through with EPA, US EPA, and US Ecology to resolve some of the issues. The big issue being here is the waste analysis plan. And until we are satisfied that we've got a license that is protective of human health and the environment, we're not going to make the decision on that.
This is a personal question, and feel free not to answer it if you don't want to, but would you and your family live within a mile of this U.S. Ecology hazardous waste facility?
That is a tough question. If it was in a city setting like that, my answer would be no, because I'm not a city person. But if this facility was there and I moved within a mile of it and the other surroundings were good, I would try to ensure that I understood what was going on out there and that there was a permit in place or in being protective of the human health and that their records were good in going forward. I would be proactive, like a lot of the citizens are around there, to make sure that what's occurring at that location is being done to the best standards that are out there.
Richard Conforti is a supervisor for the Management and Tracking Unit for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Let's stay with this U.S. Ecology expansion story for a moment. Noah Hall is a professor of law at Wayne State University and the founder of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center, which we referenced earlier. So how common is it for a hazardous waste treatment facility like this to be located in the middle of a city?
Well, unfortunately, it's relatively common in poor, underrepresented, and often minority and immigrant neighborhoods in cities, and Detroit is no exception. We don't see a facility like this, of course, in some of the more prosperous parts of a city or in the parts of a city that political leaders are looking to economic development. Instead, we see waste sites like this, along with all other sorts of toxic emissions and poisons, being situated in some of the most vulnerable and disenfranchised communities, even though, such as here, it's where thousands of people and families are living.
As I mentioned, some of the nearby residents feel this is a case of environmental racism. Conforti with the DEQ says this facility has been on that site since the 1950s. Does that social justice claim hold up when many of those folks moved near that plant since it was established?
Well, sure. And trying to turn a polluting source and a disenfranchised community into a chicken and egg problem really dodges the issue and fails to take responsibility. The reality is that thousands of families are living here. Every day, more children are born in this neighborhood. They're coming here for a quality of life, and instead they're moving to a neighborhood where the state is green-lighting the expansion of a toxic waste facility that none of us would want in our backyards.
At least two Detroit City Council members have protested this expansion of the U.S. Ecology Hazardous Waste Treatment Facility. How much power does the city or a county really have in restricting or regulating an operation like this?
Well, unfortunately, to some extent, the city and county's hands are tied. Now, the city and county will have some options, and there's a lot that they can be doing at the local level to mitigate the impacts and try to minimize how harmful this is going to be to the neighborhood. But at the end of the day, these are decisions made by our State Department of Environmental Quality. And the citizens of Detroit, and really citizens of the entire state, deserve a Department of Environmental Quality that is looking out for them and their public health.
U.S. Ecology did enter an agreement with the city of Detroit, which includes the ability to fine the company or even shut down the facility if it's violating its permit requirements. How rare is that?
The details of that are not clear, and it's the concept of a partnership with local enforcement is actually fairly common. Your county prosecutor, your city attorney have the ability to enforce state law. And so a separate enforcement agreement with the local authorities is not that uncommon. The details of how that enforcement would be coordinated and what role there is for citizens to participate and oversee the enforcement is a key question.
A colleague of yours wants the DEQ to hold another public hearing. There were lots of public hearings held in regard to Nestle's request for water extraction, and tens of thousands of people expressed opposition, and it didn't move the needle. What good does your colleague think he'll get out of a second public hearing on the U.S. ecology expansion?
Well, first of all, the purpose of public participation is not just to get an eventual decision, but to empower the community and make clear that the community is a part of the decision making. The DEQ has failed to hold the public hearings that this community deserves, not just the number of public hearings, but in the languages and in the forums that are accessible to the people in this community. We have a lot of folks in the community who don't speak English, who have a difficult time reaching certain forums and submitting comments online. And the DEQ needs to and should want to hear from members of the community. And community empowerment is important for its own sake. Of course, we hope it will eventually lead to a better decision by the DEQ, but we're realistic. We fight the DEQ every day on behalf of communities because the DEQ simply does not listen to the citizens of the state.
We asked the DEQ about U.S. Ecology's record. The Free Press found that U.S. Ecology released chemicals into the city sewer system that exceeded regulatory limits more than 150 times in a six-year period. How common is it that facilities regulated by the Department of Environmental Quality violate the rules, they're fined, but then are granted permits or licenses to expand or increase release of pollutants?
I'm sorry to say, but unfortunately, that's all too common a scenario, especially in disenfranchised communities and in populations that our political system hasn't cared much about. We see over and over again facilities with horrendous track records. Of course, US Ecology isn't even the only one in Detroit. We've got the Detroit incinerator, which has been the subject of violations and enforcements,
refineries,
I hate to say, essentially
steel
since
mills,
I've been doing this work.
Yeah.
And they continue to get the permitting support of the state agency. I think really the fundamental problem is that our State Department of Environmental Quality does not live up to its name. Its mission and its focus is not protecting the environment on behalf of communities and citizens. It seems to be to facilitate economic development, including often hazardous and polluting facilities.
Noah Hall is a professor of law at Wayne State University and the founder of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's hear from a spokesperson for U.S. Ecology. John Truscott joins us. Welcome to Stateside.
Glad to be here.
If U.S. Ecology is not increasing the amount of hazardous waste it intends to process, then why does the company need to make this expansion to store nine times as much hazardous waste on site?
Well, I think you have to realize first we're talking about a permit renewal that occurs pretty much every 10 years by regulatory standards. And the facility itself isn't changing, but updated market conditions, demands from consumers, customers, require changes. So nobody's talking about increasing the size of the facility or anything, but there may be some products coming in that have changed in terms of weight or load or things like that. So this is really just to be prepared for, in the future, potential market condition changes.
There are more than 10,000 people living within a mile of this U.S. Ecology operation on the east side of Detroit, including folks who live in Hamtramck. What is the company's reaction to their concerns, the residents' concerns, about U.S. Ecology's plans to bring in a lot more hazardous materials into their neighborhood?
Well, U.S. Ecology's first and foremost concern is for protection of the environment, and then also being a good neighbor and making sure that the community and the neighbors are protected and treated well. Nothing in this permit suggests otherwise, and there have been a number of discussions with community members, with the city. There are some agreements being negotiated with the city in terms of how things will be handled. So all efforts are being made to first be compliant and protective of the environment, and then also to work with the community. So we hear the concerns. We're glad to talk to them and work with them. And I think really once you get the true and accurate information out there, it will start to alleviate many of their concerns.
As you know, the Free Press reported U.S. Ecology exceeded permit levels of toxic chemicals going into the city of Detroit's sewer system 150 times, more than 150 times between 2010 and 2016. What has U.S. Ecology done to ensure that it won't be doing that in the future?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question because in that timeline, most of the exceedances happened before U.S. Ecology bought the facility in 2012, and there have been major and significant improvements since then. You know, we're never happy unless it's absolutely perfect 100% of the time. That's a very difficult standard to meet 100% of the time, but there have been so many improvements made, and we'll continue to monitor and make further improvements. And I think once people see the timeline and all of those improvements, they'll see that significant efforts have been made and achieved.
I'm curious, when U.S. Ecology pre-treats these hazardous chemicals such as PCBs, arsenic, mercury, and so on, what does it do to make it safe enough to be released into the sewers and then, after municipal treatment, released into the Great Lakes system?
Well, I'm certainly not an engineer or a water treatment specialist, but what happens here is this is a very, very heavily regulated area, both with what's coming in and what's going out. So there are certain chemicals that can be removed from the water stream or diluted so significantly that there is virtually no detection by the time it goes out. And so what happens with this is there's a lot of cooperation with the local water system. So first, what's going in is safe or can at least be adequately treated in the local water system before it's put into the water stream. So there is great care. It's monitored virtually around the clock. And the EPA and the DEQ are on this 24 hours a day. So we can say with certainty that this is very safe by the time it's treated and goes through the process.
John Truscott is a public relations manager speaking for U.S. Ecology. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who out-experted the expert today. Good job, Rusty. He's in there. He's so excited. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, Gabby Horton, and Sophie Sherry. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.